Disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find out more about us and our work at www.deadsoulspodcast.com or over on Instagram by searching our name. As always, thank you for joining us. I previously recorded a trilogy of episodes regarding the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Of those 3 episodes, unfortunately, only 2 were released due to a legal issue surrounding the 3rd episode. Well, tonight, I will be discussing the contents of that 3rd episode. Further, I strongly believe the information in tonight's episode to be true and actual events that surrounded the conspiracy of JFK's assassination. Can I prove it? Of course not. I would be a wealthy man if I could. I do, however, firmly believe that there is enough physical evidence, along with eyewitness testimony from credible sources, to support the outcome I am proposing. It is, however, not the outcome everyone wants to accept or hear. I think over the coming decades, the evidence, once finally in the public domain, will support tonight's hypothesis. As always, I hope you will take the information, evidence, data, and testimony that I share with you tonight and make up your own minds. My mission is not to force my agenda or beliefs on you, but merely to share the evidence and give you the opportunity to arrive at your own conclusions and form your own beliefs. I stand tonight, as I record this, with my hand on my heart, and I say to each of you, this is what I truly believe happened to President John F. Kennedy, and who specifically were responsible for one of the biggest crimes in the history of the United States. This is The Crooked Men. History. What is it? The Cambridge Dictionary defines it as the study of, or record of, past events considered together, especially events of a particular period, country, or subject. Merriam-Webster, for my friends over the pond, gives us the following definition of history. A chronological record of significant events, such as those affecting a nation or institution, often including an explanation of their causes. And finally, the experts over at Oxford University state that history encompasses the academic study of the past of the human race, stretching back as far as the earliest written records. You guys know this, though. We all know what history is. Hell, we probably all studied it to some degree in our schooling. But have any of you ever stopped to consider that history is subjective? My history might not be your history. An example of this is the Second World War. The common Western narrative is that Japan surrendered to the Allies following the detonation of the 2 atomic bombs by the United States, thus making Japan realize that with weapons that powerful, they could not possibly win the war. This isn't the general feeling in Japan, however. Japanese historians will tell you that Japan had already decided to surrender to the Allies prior to the atomic bombs being dropped. They aimed to save the lives of many of their citizens and also to avoid a mass ground war on their mainland. Japanese historians will say that the reason the Americans dropped the atomic bombs was to demonstrate to the Soviet Union the level of power that the United States had in order to prevent a further war with Russia, which was looming on the horizon even at that time. 2 different scenarios where the outcome and events were exactly the same, but the context and reasoning are completely different. History is riddled with this. You ever hear the phrase, history is written by the winners? That's true to a point, but there is a history actually written by the losers too, if you search hard enough. If you have some spare time, Google this phrase, the myth of the clean Wehrmacht. This will turn up some reading material regarding the generally accepted notion, particularly in Germany, that the Wehrmacht, or the regular German army, were not involved in the Nazi atrocities during the Second World War. That in fact, the horrific actions against the Jews and the evil war crimes were all conducted by the SS and hardline Nazis. German General Franz Halder was a key player in the perpetuation that the Nazis were the bad guys, but the regular German army were just fighting for their country's freedom, most honourably. General Halder submitted this opinion in a memorandum to the Nuremberg trials in November 1945. German field marshals Walter von Braunschweig and Erich von Manstein co-signed the views of the memorandum, as well as a number of other senior German army officials. This has become the general consensus in Germany, and it's a way that many Germans who had family members partake in the war are able to accept the actions of their relatives and distance themselves and family from the evil Nazis. The only problem with this widely accepted view is that it's pure bullshit. It was created by the United States intelligence services, in particular General William J. Donovan of the OSS. At the end of the Second World War, Donovan viewed the Soviet Union as a global threat to world peace. He felt the world was heading quickly towards another global conflict. Donovan served as a deputy prosecutor at Nuremberg, and he and some other US representatives believed the trials should not proceed. He felt that America should secure Germany as a military ally against the Soviet Union in the growing Cold War, and to do this, he wanted to portray the German army in a positive light. So, he aimed to separate them from the evil Nazis in the eyes of the public. Baron Morris Hanke, advisor to Winston Churchill, also felt the same way, and thus the United States and the United Kingdom, as they always do, manipulated history for their preferred outcome. The true story, of course, is that the German army, the Wehrmacht, were just as guilty, just as involved in the Holocaust and inhumane war crimes as the SS were, and there is significant evidence to support that. The first book to talk about this was in 1969. Manfred Messerschmidt published a book on the ideological indoctrination in the Wehrmacht, titled Die Wehrmacht, eine Staatszeit der Indoctrination. While the book did not deal with specific war crimes directly, it did challenge the popular claim of an apolitical Wehrmacht that had largely escaped Nazi influence. I will add a list of further reading into this subject on our website. If you head over to www.deadsoulspodcast.com/history, and I'll add a bounty of reference materials for you to refer to there. Whilst this is a fascinating subject in its own right, this isn't the topic we are talking about this evening. It's a small deviation to get you guys to think about history, and to think just how much we really know, and how much of accepted history is opinion, or the suggested narrative from a government, perhaps. Know this. Historians have different versions of history, from writing the events in a particular time, because each has their own perceptions of it. They may use different historical sources, choose a particular focus, and interpret facts in a different way from one another. They may also have a bias based on any number of factors. You'll often find historians argue over the accepted story, and what they want to agree is the accepted narrative. It doesn't mean, of course, what they agree on actually happened in the way they agree on, though. Take historians who study ancient Egypt, for example, or pre-15th century South American civilizations, or even some Native American tribes. There are ongoing ferocious debates, and those are just three examples. These issues reflect a lot of problems the general public are having with mass media in our current day and age. There is often skepticism over agenda. What are the reports leaving out? Or are they pushing the story in a certain way, or to favor a specific group, person, or government? History is mass media of the past. The only key to unlocking both history and mass media is context. What we know, why that happened, and by whom, when, and where. What led to that event happening and the information around those events? Research, research, research. Generally, if the evidence and data suggest something and there is strong opposition from another party, it's important to assess why they feel a differing opinion is correct and how they achieved their conclusions. It's all pretty exhausting, but we now live in an age where the most valuable commodity is data, and it's worth 10 times more than gold. With all that said, let's root around in 20th century history for a bit. Whenever the debate comes up as to who the worst president in the United States was, there is always feverish debate. When it comes to the best, there's a fairly general consensus. Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Franklin D. Roosevelt, or Thomas Jefferson are almost always at the top of the list. But worst, well, that position is regularly up for grabs. Many people have their thoughts and opinions, and there are many ways by which one can gauge the outcome. However, when it came to subterfuge, lying, intimidation, hypocrisy, bigotry, fraud, and outright murder, allegedly, few can touch on one man, President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Who was Lyndon Baines Johnson? Why is he both reviled and also revered, depending on who you talk to? Lyndon Baines Johnson was born on August the 27th, 1908, in Gillespie County, Texas. He was the first of five children, born to Sam Ely Johnson Jr., a businessman and farmer, and also a state legislator, and his wife, Rebecca Baines Johnson. On November the 17th, 1934, Johnson married Claudia Alter Lady Bird Taylor, whose wealthy family ensured Johnson's political success. In 1937, Johnson was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives as a Democrat. He reported for active military duty on December of 1941 and served in the U.S. Navy as a lieutenant commander until all members of Congress who were serving in the military were recalled to Washington in the summer of 1942. While Johnson served in the Navy, he was awarded the nation's third highest combat decoration, a medal he reportedly received following a 1942 fact-finder mission aboard the B-26 medium-class bomber named the Heckling Hare. Its mission was simply to take photographs of an enemy installation. According to historian Barrett Tillman, the mission on the 9th of June 1942 was codenamed Toe 9, and it involved 11 Martin B-26 Marauder fast twin-engine bombers of the 22nd Bomb Group out of Port Moresby, New Guinea. Their assigned target was Ley Aerodrome, an important Japanese installation on New Guinea's northern coast. Diversionary attacks by the B-25 Mitchells and a B-17 Flying Fortress were deployed to cover the 22nd's approach. Now, the official rationale for Johnson receiving the Silver Star Medal is one surrounded in a fair amount of controversy because he was never even in active combat. Johnson's biographer, Robert Caro, stated in his book that Johnson wore the Silver Star pen on the lapels of his suit jackets for the rest of his life. Caro's book, titled Means of Ascent, takes umbrage at Johnson receiving the medal for what was essentially him spending just a few minutes under enemy fire, but even that description overstates the actual incident. Lyndon Johnson never got within sight of Japanese forces in actual fact. His combat experience was actually a myth. Barrett Tillman provides the following, and I quote, "Once back home, LBJ lost no time stomping the campaign trail, using his medal to further his image." Caro adds that Johnson had the Silver Star presented to him repeatedly, with each occasion him acting as though it was being awarded for the first time. Johnson is also on record as telling audiences during his campaign that as he saw, quote, 14 zeros shot down in flames. This never happened. The decoration remains a sore point with many of the 22nd Bomb Group veterans. The crew chief of the B-26 Heckling Hare, retired Master Sergeant Woodrow W. Harrison, said, and I quote, "As to the strangeness of LBJ's Silver Star, well, no other crew member aboard that plane on that mission received one." Equally adamant was Gunner Robert Marshall, who said, quote, We didn't know LBJ was awarded the Silver Star until some years later when the book came out. We didn't like it. If he got it, so should everyone else on that mission. In 1948, Lyndon Johnson was elected to the US Senate in the Democratic primary, where he won the primary by just 87 votes. Considered to this day to be a very questionable election. His ability to work with Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower and unite fellow Democrats behind important legislation made him a powerful force, but Johnson had problems closer to home. Namely, a sister by the name of Josepha Johnson. A sister who happened to hate Lyndon Johnson and his entire family. According to multiple biographers and independent investigators, I refer you back to our website for a full list of sources, deadsoulspodcast.com/history, Josepha Johnson, who was divorced twice, became a prostitute and drug addict, behaviors which posed significant risk in those days to the family's name, reputation, and their credibility in both federal and state politics. Josepha had affairs with associates of Johnson, namely Jim Kinzer and Mack Wallace, the second name there being someone who was known as Johnson's fixer. Jim Kinzer wanted LBJ to loan him money via Josepha, but LBJ considered it to be a shakedown, a possible blackmail attempt. Josepha had told Kinzer about a number of her brother's illegal activities, and Johnson found out. So, on October the 22nd, 1951, Mack Wallace shot Kinzer, which helped Johnson in keeping Kinzer quiet. Wallace was arrested and charged with the murder, but was released on bail after Edward Clark arranged for the two of Johnson's financial supporters, Emmy Ruby and Bill Carroll, to post the bond for Wallace. Johnson's personal attorney, John Cofer, also agreed to represent Wallace. Eventually, Mack Wallace was found guilty of first-degree murder with a jury voting 11-1 for the death penalty. This was then overruled, however, by Judge Charles O. Betts, who happened to be a friend of LBJ. Instead, it was announced that Wallace would serve a sentence of 5 years imprisonment. Judge Betts then suspended the sentence and Wallace was immediately freed. A man found guilty of first-degree murder just let go. Additionally, it's worth noting that at the time in Texas law, the jurors in a trial had to agree to the judge's sentence. In this case, all of the jury agreed to the amended outcome unanimously, even though it was dramatically different to what they initially set down. According to journalist and researcher Bill Adler of the Texas Observer, a large number of the jurors telephoned John Kinzer's parents to apologize for agreeing to a suspended sentence, but said that they did so because threats had been made against their lives and their families' lives. Now, let's talk about a man called Billy Sol Estes, which is another point of interest in LBJ's background and someone Johnson was connected to. Estes cut a lucrative deal with LBJ. Estes ran a scam using federal agricultural subsidies. According to Estes himself, he obtained $21 million a year for growing and storing non-existent crops of cotton. This would certainly pose a major problem for Johnson politically if it ever got out, and guess what? His sister Josepha knew all about it. In 1960, Henry Marshall with the US Department of Agriculture began investigating Johnson and Estes in regards to their illegal business of defrauding the government. Marshall was offered a promotion to Washington, D.C. in exchange for dropping the investigation into Johnson and Estes, but he refused. According to Estes, on January the 17th, 1961, Lyndon Johnson told Mack Wallace, quote, get rid of him. Marshall was subsequently murdered in order to keep him quiet and protect Johnson and Estes, but mostly Johnson. According to Estes' testimony under oath, Mack Wallace followed Marshall to a remote area of his farm and beat him until he was almost unconscious. Then he tried to asphyxiate him with the exhaust from Marshall's own pickup truck. Wallace thought he heard someone approaching the scene and hastily grabbed a rifle. Mack Wallace then fired 5 shots into Marshall, killing him instantly, and fled the scene. Messier than he had wanted. Through LBJ's connections with the local law enforcement, the murder was ruled as a suicide. 5 rifle shots to the chest, a suicide. No pictures were taken of the crime scene, no blood samples were taken from the stains on Marshall's truck, and no fingerprints were taken from the truck or rifle. The truck was washed and waxed the following day. At around the same time as these events, John F. Kennedy brought Johnson on to be his running mate in the 1960 presidential election. Kennedy thought by having Johnson be his running mate, it would secure Southern conservative votes. Johnson, though, had to make sure his background was squeaky clean. Following the election, John F. Kennedy appointed his brother Robert Kennedy as Attorney General. RFK almost immediately began an investigation into Johnson. He began talking to witnesses and started looking in the direction of Josepha Johnson. The official story is that Josepha had died of a cerebral hemorrhage on December 25, 1961, and was found in her bed at home. State law at the time specified that an autopsy should have been carried out in the circumstances around her death. You guessed it, no autopsy was conducted, and it's unclear as to why. But one thing is for sure, if no autopsy was conducted, how could they know the specific cause of death, especially one with no exterior signs or symptoms? Some 23 years later, lawyer Douglas Caddy wrote to Stephen S. Trott of the U.S. Department of Justice. In the letter, Caddy claimed that Billy Solestes, Lyndon B. Johnson, Mack Wallace, and Cliff Carter had been involved in the murders of several people, which included Josepha Johnson and John Kinzer. We will come back to Caddy shortly, but for now, just know that Caddy was briefly the counsel for the 5 men arrested in the Watergate burglaries. He was also counsel and close friend of a man named E. Howard Hunt, again, someone who we will come back to shortly. In 1960, Kennedy won the extremely close election against the Vice President, Richard Nixon. The election had a number of irregularities about it, and there was alleged widespread fraud and vote buying in favor of Kennedy by his father, Joseph Kennedy Sr. It is alleged that Joseph Kennedy recruited his mafia friends and associates through mob boss Sam Giancana in major cities like Chicago. Allegations were made of Giancana employees bundling ballots and coercing voters to vote for Kennedy. So Robert Kennedy was investigating Johnson and his associates for a multitude of crimes. Johnson was backed into a corner, and as he knew the investigators had full Democrat support in Congress, mainly from members who hated Johnson. It's worth noting that after JFK was killed on November 22, 1963, all of these investigations went away. We know that Kennedy was shot and killed while riding in the presidential motorcade in Dallas, Texas. Johnson, being the vice president, was sworn in as president later that day aboard Air Force One. It was also no secret that Johnson hated John Kennedy. The two men were polar opposites, and Johnson despised the Ivy League snotty and showy personality that Kennedy gave off. Johnson hated the fact that he had gone from one of the most powerful men in Washington, D.C., to a neutered and reduced shadow of himself, kept tightly under control by the Kennedy brothers. Johnson was also aware that due to Bobby Kennedy's investigations into his business dealings and questionable behaviors, that JFK planned to drop Johnson from the 1964 presidential ticket. Johnson's power was waning. But now, none of that was a problem anymore. Johnson was president. Defeating Republican candidate Barry Goldwater by more than 15 million votes in the 1964 presidential election, Johnson then introduced a slate of new reforms, which he said would build a great society for all Americans. Johnson was looking to run for re-election, and he needed to secure the black votes, many of whom were not yet convinced by Johnson, even though he had implemented the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Johnson also began working on his Great Society program to ensure that black African Americans would have a good reason to vote for Democrats in the future. His plan was to have American taxpayer money dispersed primarily among the black community in particular, but also poor white citizens who were all generally impoverished and less educated. However, the expansion of government and a strategy focused on handouts that discouraged self-improvement caused more harm than good and ultimately did not help the poor. Project 21 spokesman Derek Green said in a 2014 quote, "Five decades later, after President Johnson initiated the war on poverty, America remained at around the same percentage of people still living in poverty as it did back then. In 1964, the poverty rate was approximately 19%, and today, it's still around 15%. Statistics such as these demonstrate the war on poverty was a continually mismanaged disaster," Green added. Next, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed, but this saw significant struggle and filibuster before the votes in the Senate and House of Representatives allowed it through. Despite Johnson's ego and disinterest in people in general, he did manage to do some other things that did help Americans. Things such as the Social Security Amendments Act of 1965, which created Medicare and Medicaid. He re-emphasized JFK's position of supporting NASA's Apollo program and made it a national priority in 1967. He nominated black civil rights lawyer Thurgood Marshall to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he passed the Gun Control Act of October 22, 1968. Much of these positives, however, were seen as little more than being for political optics. Lyndon Johnson stated publicly that he would, and I quote, "not send American boys to do what South Vietnamese boys should be doing for themselves." Johnson then did the opposite. The Johnson family, along with Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's family, were heavily invested in the military industry. Johnson and his wife Lady Bird were investors in Bell Aircraft that made the UH-1 Iroquois Huey helicopter, among others. McNamara owned massive stock in the Ford Motor Company, which were making military vehicles. Many others on Capitol Hill were also big investors in the war industry. So there was more than a whiff of hypocrisy when politicians voiced opposition to the war in Vietnam. On August 7th, following the engineered Gulf of Tonkin incident, Johnson brought the United States officially into a war that would last until 1975 and see over 52,000 American troops killed. Investment portfolios exploded as the war industry went full throttle to supply the military. Johnson, McNamara, and others made a significant amount of money from the war. Johnson and his wife also owned Lady Bird Manufacturing Company. They were manufacturers of military ammunition, which they sold globally, including to the North Vietnamese military, who then used the ammunition against US soldiers. When this was reported at the time, the organization's defense was that the ammunition was sold on via third parties and out of their control. According to some of Johnson's detractors, the wealth he gained from his military business interests is one of the many reasons why he wanted the war to continue. There are also multiple allegations that he received kickbacks from other large military manufacturers who were invested in the war. I will add here that these are simply allegations. I haven't been able to find solid evidence to support the kickback allegation, only comments from observers, shall we say. I just want to ensure I'm clear about this. What is on record and evidence, though, is that Johnson invested in several companies, namely Day and Zimmerman, who were awarded the government construction contracts to build air bases such as the United States Air Force Base in Korat, Thailand, among others. When Johnson died on January 22, 1973, he was worth around $100 million. To convert that into current financial figures, it would equate to just short of $1 billion today. For those listening at a future date, this conversion is as per September 2023. On August 9, 1984, Billy Sol Estes' lawyer, Douglas Caddy, who we mentioned earlier, wrote to Stephen S. Trott of the U.S. Department of Justice. In his letter to Trott, he stated, quote, "Mr. Estes is willing to testify that Lyndon Baines Johnson ordered the following killings and that he transmitted his orders through Cliff Carter to Mac Wallace, who then executed the murders. Mr. Estes was a member of a four-member group headed by Lyndon Johnson, which committed criminal acts in Texas in the 1960s. The other two, besides Mr. Estes and LBJ, were Cliff Carter and Mac Wallace. Mr. Estes is willing to disclose his knowledge concerning the following criminal offenses. Number 1, the killing of Henry Marshall. Number 2, the killing of George Krutliak. Number 3, the killing of Ike Rogers and his secretary, Harold Orr. Number 5, the killing of Coleman Wade. Number 6, the killing of Josepha Johnson. Number 7, the killing of John Kinzer. Number 8, the bombshell, the killing of President John F. Kennedy. In the cases of murder numbers 1 through 7, Mr. Estes' knowledge of the precise details concerning the way their murders were executed stems from conversations he had shortly after each event with Cliff Carter and Mac Wallace. In addition, a short time after Mr. Estes was released from prison in 1971, he met with Cliff Carter and they reminisced about what had occurred in the past, including the murders. During their conversation, Carter orally compiled a list of 17 murders which had been committed, some of which Mr. Estes was unfamiliar with. A living witness was present at that meeting and should be willing to testify about it. He is Kyle Brown, recently of Houston and now living in Brady, Texas. Mr. Estes states that Mac Wallace, whom he describes as a stone killer with a communist background, recruited Jack Ruby, who in turn recruited Lee Harvey Oswald. Mr. Estes says that the Mafia did not participate in the Kennedy assassination, but that its participation was discussed prior to the event, but rejected by LBJ directly, who believed if the Mafia were involved, he would never be out from under their blackmail. Strangely, Mac Wallace himself was killed in a suspicious car accident in 1971. So let's hold on for a second. Lyndon Baines Johnson was behind the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So other than the testimony before a Robertson County grand jury in Texas, which is what Estes ultimately underwent, what evidence or testimony do we have to entertain this notion? Well, let's jump right in. On June 19th, 1992, former Texas Ranger and U.S. Marshal Clint Peoples told a friend that he had documented evidence that LBJ's associate, Mac Wallace, was one of the shooters in Dealey Plaza during the Kennedy assassination. He also confidently stated that he had information on the 18 material witnesses to the JFK shooting who all died within 3 years of the event. For transparency, I will list the names of all of the 18 witnesses on the webpage for this episode so that you can look into them all for yourself. Just head over to deadsoulspodcast.com/history. Fun fact. The London Times calculated the likelihood of all 18 witnesses dying within the 3 years of JFK's assassination. That figure was 1 in 100,000 trillion. Anyway. On June 23, 1992, just 4 days after revealing he had incriminating evidence against Mac Wallace and details of the 18 witnesses' deaths, Clint Peoples was killed in a mysterious one-car automobile accident in Texas. Maybe that was just a coincidence, though. Jumping back to LBJ, U.S. Air Force General Curtis E. LeMay stated that Johnson never did anything to benefit anyone in society, laws or otherwise, unless it specifically benefited him politically and personally. The only reason Johnson pushed to get the Welfare Act passed was to, quote, secure the black vote for Democrats forever, he said. On a side note, Madeline Duncan Brown, who was well known as being Johnson's longtime mistress for 20 years and died in 2002, vehemently claimed that his son Stephen was born out of that relationship with Johnson. This claim was supported by Barr McClellan, a lawyer who worked for Johnson's White House staff, who confirmed that he arranged personally regular payments from Johnson to Brown to support the upbringing of Stephen. The payments to Brown were made via a money laundering corporation account which Johnson held, named Brazos 10th. Brown stated this and McClellan confirmed. Brown also implicated Johnson in the conspiracy to assassinate President John F. Kennedy. She released her autobiography in 1997 via the University of Wisconsin's Conservatory Press. It's titled, Texas in the Morning, the Love Story of Madeline Brown and President Lyndon Baines Johnson. The book appears to be out of print currently, but looking online, copies are selling for around $800, should you fancy. Regarding Mac Wallace and Lyndon Johnson's connection to the JFK assassination, well, on March 12, 1998, Mac Wallace's fingerprint as was recorded in 1951 when he was arrested, was positively matched with a copy of a fingerprint labeled as unknown. The unknown fingerprint had been lifted by investigators on November the 22nd, 1963, from a shipping carton located near the southeast side of the sixth-floor window of the Texas School Book Depository Building. This is the exact location where Lee Harvey Oswald was supposed to have shot Kennedy from. The carton is labeled Box A in the JFK evidence held in the National Archives. It contains several fingerprints. Some are identified as those of Lee Harvey Oswald, and another belongs to Mack Wallace, LBJ's fixer. There are also several still unidentified. If nothing else, this is hard evidence, which would be usable in a court of law, which poses that a close associate of Lyndon Johnson was in the same room as JFK's supposed assassin on the day of the assassination. That room just so happens to be the room where the assassin's bullet was supposedly fired from. That is pretty damning evidence. But I'm not finished yet. In 2012, a book was published by St. John Hunt titled Bond of Secrecy. I'll pop a link to where you can get the book or the Kindle version on our website, should you so wish to dig deeper. The following information is taken from that book, so all credit to its author. It's August 2003 in Miami, Florida. The temperature is 95 degrees Fahrenheit or about 35 degrees Celsius. The air is suffocating and humid. One very sick man lays on his bed thinking back over his time, knowing that the end is near. The man is called Everett Howard Hunt. History remembers him as E. Howard Hunt. At 84 years old, E. Howard Hunt has lived a long and very colorful life. He's certainly seen the world, traveling extensively while in the service of his country, or at least the men who ran it. Hunt is a former CIA agent. He worked in black ops and had a hidden hand in some of the 20th century's biggest historical events: assassinations, coup d'etats, wars, propaganda, and disinformation. Throughout his career in the intelligence service, he'd been involved in some of the world's most volatile trouble spots. He was a man involved in the administrations of Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. He worked behind the scenes, pulling strings and doing whatever was necessary to further America's interests. His area of expertise, his speciality you could say, was dirty tricks, underhanded tactics, and shady plots. Quite the resume. You may know him, or at least remember his name, as one that came up during the Watergate scandal that involved President Nixon in 1972. You'll recall I briefly mentioned him earlier also. Well, at this stage in his life, he has prostate cancer, which has spread into his jaw. His body is racked with pain from lupus, rheumatism, and gangrene. His left leg has been amputated, and a recent bout of pneumonia has left him weaker than ever. He also has fluid on the lungs that make him sound like a wheezing death rattle. He's not a stupid man. He knows that death lay just around the corner. Hunt's relationship with his elder son, St. John, wasn't always a good one. In fact, that's probably an understatement. St. John Hunt was a 20-year meth addict and a drug dealer for 10 of those years. By August 2003, though, St. John is clean and sober and has been for a number of years. He's wanted to reconcile with his father for a while, but where to even start with the years of tangled drama that their relationship has behind them? Some background on St. John. He started off with the odds bet against him. He was born with a club foot, dyslexia, a stutter, and suffering with regular petit mal or absent seizures. St. John said he was not the super son his cool and debonair dad wanted at all. Hunt was embarrassed by him. When St. John was a teenager, Hunt wanted him to attend a prestigious prep school, so arranged with the school for them both to attend a lavish dinner at the campus with the dean and school governors. Hunt was hoping the dinner would secure his place in the school. However, during the dinner, St. John whispered to his father, stating that he needed the bathroom. But Hunt just glared back at St. John in a "don't you dare fuck this up" kind of way. Ultimately, St. John pissed his pants at the dinner and thus didn't get offered a place at the school. Another embarrassment for good old dad. St. John would end up attending a less prestigious boarding school in Maryland called the St. James School. That is, until St. John was sexually molested by a male teacher when he was 14 years old. St. John remembers how he confided to his mother what had happened. His mother Dorothy, despite St. John begging with her, told Howard Hunt. The same day, Hunt turned up at the school in a rented Cadillac with a trunk full of guns and rifles. St. John never returned to the school after that day. Neither did the teacher who molested him, and no one knows what happened to him. Most people would see what happened to St. John as a tragic and sad incident, placing him well and truly as the victim in the situation. Not Hunt. He was utterly embarrassed by his son being the victim and being molested. He saw this as weakness on his son's part. This is the kind of man E. Howard Hunt was. Back to 2003. St. John knows that his father is on the way out, so to speak, and he thinks this may be the last chance to reconcile with him. St. John also has some questions for his father about his time in the CIA. One question in particular. Exactly where was his father, E. Howard Hunt, on the day President Kennedy was shot? According to St. John, he asked his father outright where he was that day. Hunt grabs a piece of paper and writes three letters at the top, LBJ, and then draws a box around them. Beneath the letters and connected to them by lines in a sort of spider chart, Hunt writes a series of names, also each enclosed by a box. The names are Cord Meyer, Bill Harvey, and David Morales. Beneath the last name and connected by another line, Hunt writes French gunman, Grassy Knoll. His father has just sketched out the key players in a plot to murder John F. Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States. The three names that his father has written down, Meyer, Harvey, and Morales, were senior CIA agents at the time of the assassination. But the most sensational element of what Hunt has written is the three letters at the top of the page, the three letters that connect all the names. LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson. A few days after Hunt gives St. John the names of the JFK conspirators, Howard Hunt writes a fuller narrative of the plot to kill Kennedy. More names come to light. David Attlee Phillips, the CIA's chief of Cuban operations at the time. Antonio Veciana, a Cuban exile working as part of Operation Mongoose, or the Cuban Operation, a joint CIA/Department of Defense black op to remove Castro from power in Cuba. And another name, a man with Cuban connections, Frank Sturgis. Hunt's account details how one of the conspirators, CIA agent Cord Meyer, met Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City. This supports eyewitness accounts placing Oswald in Mexico City. Hell, even the Warren Commission stated that Oswald was in Mexico. They say trying to obtain a visa to get into Cuba though, which never really made sense. According to Hunt, the plan initially was to kill JFK in Miami, but LBJ changed the itinerary to Dallas for personal reasons. Following up from the written account, Hunt also records audio tapes of him describing the plot and had them sent to St. John's California address. Hunt has nothing to gain from his confessions. They are considered deathbed confessions. But Hunt doesn't die. Well, not in August 2003 anyway. In fact, Hunt doesn't die for another 4 years. His health actually improves and he regrets sharing his secrets with his son. Hunt now wants the notes and his audio tapes back. St. John, obviously, in the ever so dysfunctional family, makes copies. He's sure to state that it was never about making money for him. More, it was about the reconciliation with his dad and revealing what really happened on that day in November 63. Movie star Kevin Costner reaches out to offer St. John $5 million for all the information on the tapes and that Hunt wrote down. But St. John turned the money down. Costner would confirm this in a 2007 Rolling Stone article. Let's take a deeper look into the life and career of E. Howard Hunt and the historical, documented facts that surround him. Hunt is born in 1918. His father, Everett Howard Hunt Sr., is an attorney. and the family lives in an affluent lifestyle in a large colonial-style house in Hamburg, New York, situated just 33 miles south of Niagara Falls and 7 miles from the shores of Lake Erie. Hunt enjoys all that comes with a privileged, middle-class, white upbringing. Hunt graduates from Brown University with a degree in English in 1940, but World War II gets in the way of life, and Hunt joins the Navy, serving on the destroyer USS Mayo in the North Atlantic. He is given a medical discharge in 1943 following an accident aboard the ship. But this isn't the end of Hunt's involvement in the war just yet. He is recruited by the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, a new agency formed by William Donovan and the precursor to the CIA, which it would morph into in 1947. Hunt is just 24 years old. While in the OSS, Hunt is trained in all the skills of modern espionage. These include sabotage, hand-to-hand combat, how to disarm and kill an enemy stronger than yourself, survival techniques, and using ciphers and codes. His first posting is to China, where OSS operations, unofficially of course, included arming and training local resistance groups to fight in areas occupied by the Japanese forces. They are there in support of Mao Zedong's Red Army. Hunt later stated that his role there was to operate outside of Japanese strongholds, dynamiting convoys and bridges, infiltrating Chinese agents into coastal cities to gather intelligence, and recovering and returning Allied pilots shot down on the mainland or offshore. After the war, the OSS morphs into the CIA, and Hunt continues working for the new agency. This is by now the Cold War era. The enemy is no longer the Axis powers. The enemy is now communism in whatever form it chooses to rear its ugly head. Hunt is a fervent anti-communist, so this works out particularly well. In 1951, the people of Guatemala elect President Jacobo Arbenz, who promises his electorate social reform. The American-owned United Fruit Company isn't happy about it, however. They are the number one importer of bananas to the United States, and they stand to lose huge investment, product, and land under Arbenz's sweeping reforms. So they lobby the US government to overthrow him. The job is given to E. Howard Hunt, who trains mercenaries in Honduras and engineers a CIA-backed coup d'etat in 1954. Hunt sets up propaganda broadcasts and false reports, inventing a bogus rebel army with the aim of persuading the people of Guatemala that it's a popular front uprising. Arbenz goes into exile, and a right-wing military dictatorship takes over. In the years after the coup, 200,000 Guatemalans will lose their lives under the oppressive military regime. Fidel Castro comes to power as Prime Minister of the Republic of Cuba in 1959 following an armed communist revolution deposing President Batista. Castro has support of the Soviet Union, which is problematic for the United States, as this brings the Cold War to just 90 miles south of Miami. Under President Kennedy's predecessor, Dwight D. Eisenhower, the CIA draws up a plan to remove Castro from power, bringing about another revolution in Cuba. Vice President Richard M. Nixon is tasked by Eisenhower with overseeing the operation, while the specifics and implementation are left in the hands of the CIA. The Guatemalan coup of 54 provides a template, and E. Howard Hunt's experience has earned him a prominent role in the Cuban operation. Working alongside him is fellow CIA agent David Morales. Morales is known to be a specialist in the assassination of inconvenient foreign politicians. As the Democratic candidate for the presidency, John Kennedy is briefed on the top secret plan prior to the election in 1960, as is standard procedure. Following Kennedy's ascension to the presidency, he inherits the Eisenhower/Nixon plan to invade Cuba, but turns decidedly cold on it. He is accused of being soft on communism and not taking a hard enough line. This also angers the military-industrial complex, CIA Director Alan Dulles, and Kennedy's military advisors. They strong-arm Kennedy into putting the plan into action against his own best judgment. Kennedy eventually gives the go-ahead. In April 1961, a small army of anti-Castro Cuban exiles, backed by United States warships, land at the Bay of Pigs on the south of the island. The invasion proves to be a disaster. Kennedy blames the CIA for forcing him into a poorly planned operation, The CIA blamed Kennedy for losing his nerve and failing to back up the invasion with air support and sufficient firepower. The anti-Castro exiles are left stranded and are sitting ducks for the Cuban army. The Bay of Pigs disaster alienates Kennedy in various circles, the military, intelligence, and many on Capitol Hill. Kennedy will then fire CIA chief Alan Dulles. Other CIA agents fall foul of the purge too. Kennedy is quoted by the New York Times in 1966 as saying that he wants to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind. E. Howard Hunt's CIA career never recovers. He is demoted from the frontline duties for his part in the failure, sidelined, unappreciated, and left with resentment towards Kennedy. In his eyes, the president betrayed him. Kennedy is soft on communism. Kennedy is a danger to America. Vietnam, 1954. The country had been divided into two states, North and South. In the South, the nationalist leader, Nguyen Dung Diem, was backed by the United States due to his anti-communist stance, but Diem became unstable. He quickly turned into an oppressive dictator, and his regime started committing human rights abuses against the Buddhist population in the South. The West lost patience with him. In 1963, he falls from power in a CIA-backed military coup. Diem is assassinated along with his brother. Witnesses who were with Kennedy when he received the news say that the president is deeply shocked by the murder. E. Howard Hunt comes into possession of a number of diplomatic cables indicating that Kennedy actually approved the hit on Diem himself. Kennedy loses further support amongst his government and intelligence agencies. Years later, Hunt will admit under oath that he forged these cables. Hunt was encouraged in this task by Charles Colson, a Washington lawyer with links to Richard Nixon's presidential campaign. The plan was to make it look like Kennedy had ordered the killing of South Vietnam's leader and erode some of JFK's support in the upcoming 1964 election. These are all facts with shocking consequences, which E. Howard Hunt owned up to in a Senate committee hearing. A shocking admission, and it gives us insight into how far the CIA is willing to go to pursue their own agenda, their personal agenda, even if it's against the wishes of the American people. Hunt will consistently deny over the years that he was in Dallas on the day of Kennedy's assassination. He will even successfully sue Spotlight and Liberty Lobby magazines for defamation for claiming that he was in Dallas. In the aftermath of the assassination, police searched the rail yards near Dealey Plaza where Kennedy was shot. They find three men in a boxcar. Judging from their clothes and appearance, the men are considered hobos, homeless men. They are released without charge. In 1974, a photograph of the three men emerges for the first time. Researchers analyze the photograph and identify the men to be what they believe are CIA agents and a contract killer. Hunt is accused of being one of the tramps. The claims are denied by Hunt. But St. John Hunt remembers the day he first set eyes on the photograph. It's 1975. St. John says that he is in a phone booth in Maryland, and he sees a poster showing the three tramps taped to a nearby telegraph pole. His jaw drops. In his words, "That's my dad in the photograph." Growing up, St. John always had doubts about his father's story of where he was that day in November 1963. Hunt was not at home with his family, even though Hunt will testify on several occasions that he was. Hunt is also on record admitting over the years that he had to repeatedly remind his children that he was with them at home on November the 22nd, 1963, and that he was definitely not in Dallas. It's almost as if he was coaching his children. But why would he have to keep insisting if he was at home? Even though he was only a fifth grader at the time, St. John's memory of that day is very clear. He was at school playing on the merry-go-round during recess. The children were all called in and told the shocking news about the president, then sent home. It was a day like no other, and it's firmly embedded in his memory. His father was not there at all. In fact, St. John states that his mother told him that Hunt Sr. was away on a business trip. What's more, she had said the business trip was in Dallas, Texas. A According to Hans Sr., on the day of the assassination, he went shopping for groceries with his wife. They were planning on making Chinese food together that evening. Hans Sr. says it was something that they did often, but St. John finds his dad's story laughable. "My dad in the kitchen chopping vegetables with his wife? I'm sorry, but that would never happen, ever," St. John stated. According to St. John, his father had little time or patience for anyone in his family. In 1970, Hans Sr. finally has enough of being sidelined in the CIA over his role in the Bay of Pigs fiasco. He leaves the agency and starts working for a PR firm, although many researchers claim that this company is simply a CIA front. In 1971, Hunt gets a call from his old friend Charles Colson, the lawyer who encouraged him to forge the documents incriminating President Kennedy in President Diem's murder. Colson is now working in the White House as a special counsel to President Nixon. Colson wants to recruit Hunt for Nixon's own Dirty Tricks outfit, the Special Investigations Unit. The unit also has another name, the Plumbers. Hunt accepts the opportunity. On the evening of June 17, 1972, there's a break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate office building in Washington, D.C. Five men are caught red-handed on the premises. One of them is Frank Sturgis. One of the men also has a sole telephone number in his pocket. It's the telephone number for E. Howard Hunt. The men are charged with attempted burglary and phone tapping. The circumstantial evidence strongly suggests they were recruited by Hunt and paid by the Nixon administration. A series of expletive written audio tapes that Nixon will later be forced to release essentially confirms suspicions. The Watergate break-in turns into the biggest political scandal in American history. President Nixon resigns from office as a result. For his part in masterminding the plot, Hunt will spend 33 months in prison. Hunt's wife Dorothy will pay an even higher price. On Friday, December 8, 1972, Dorothy Hunt boards United Flight 553 from Washington National Airport to Chicago Midway. This is now 6 months after the Watergate break-in. The White House has distanced itself from the five men arrested that night, and Nixon and his special counsel, Charles Colson, foolishly still believe they can keep a lid on the scandal. E. Howard Hunt is in a potentially powerful situation. He has already been indicted for his part in the crime. Hunt knows that he could be facing a lengthy jail sentence. Hunt has the power and could potentially reveal all, give up all the names of those involved in the scandal. After all, why should he take the rap and Nixon get to walk away? So Hunt tries to negotiate some hush money. While his wife Dorothy boards her plane, she is carrying $10,000 in her purse. We will never know for sure what the money is for or where it came from. But many have speculated that it was paid by the White House to persuade the arrested men to keep quiet. Hunt is unable to travel due to his indictment, so it seems likely that Dorothy was acting as a courier on his behalf. At least, that's what St. John believes. We will never know for sure, however, because at 2:29 p.m. local time, United Flight 553 goes down over a residential area, destroying five houses in a firestorm. 45 people would die. Dorothy Hunt is one of them. Official investigation blames the crash on pilot error, but many suspect the crash was deliberate and targeted. Dorothy Hunt was traveling in the company of CBS reporter Michelle Clark. The Hunts, it is suspected, were going to blow the whistle on the Watergate conspiracy, and Michelle Clark was working on an exposé with their cooperation. Until somebody, of course, put a stop to it. E. Howard Hunt dies on January 23, 2007, at the age of 88. Hunt confessed to his son in 2003 that there was a second gunman on the grassy knoll whom he mentioned was French. This man is believed by multiple sources to be Lucien Sarti, who was part of a three-man team hired by the CIA group behind the plot. Other members of the French team were Roger Bakugnami and Sauveur Pironti, Corsican hired guns specifically brought in due to them having no links to the US, CIA, or any of its affiliates. Whilst these are just the claims of E. Howard Hunt, it's important to note that over a decade before Hunt revealed the facts about the assassination or any names, an investigative journalist named Steve J. Revelle began researching the assassination. In 1981, Revel met Christian David, the leader of a Corsican crime network in South America. David was awaiting extradition to France to stand trial for the murder of a policeman. David told Revel that Antoine Guérini, the Corsican crime boss in Marseille, had been given the contract by CIA men. David had turned the contract down as he considered the killing of a high-level US politician on US soil, which is all the info they were given initially, was too high-profile and dangerous. The contract was eventually taken up by a man named Lucien Sarti, a highly talented and experienced hitman. Sarti, Revel was told, also enlisted the help of two associates, Sauveur Pironti and Roger Bacarnomi. These were effectively the assassination B-team. These men would be in addition to the CIA group and their A-team. CIA colleagues Cord Meyer, Bill Harvey, David Attlee Phillips and David Morales, as well as the man he claims was the instigator in the entire plot, Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson. RFK, under John Kennedy, was put in place to watch over the CIA. He insisted on regular briefings at CIA headquarters in Langley. We also know that Bobby was investigating Johnson and his numerous shady dealings. On the day of JFK's murder, Bobby summons the director of the CIA, John McConey, to Hickory Hill, his huge Civil War era home in Virginia. The two men take a walk around the grounds. McConey expresses his condolences. Then, when they are out of earshot of the Secret Service, Bobby comes straight to the point. He asks McConey outright if the CIA had killed his brother, the president. Understandably, McConey is taken aback. He swears that the CIA had nothing to do with JFK's death. According to Robert Kennedy, quote, "I asked the question in a way that he couldn't lie to me." When McConey gives his version of the exchange, we begin to understand what Robert Kennedy means. McConey says that he gave his word as a man of faith, just like Robert Kennedy. He is a practicing Roman Catholic. The Attorney General has no choice but to believe him. John McConey may well have been telling the truth, though, as he understood it. It's possible that he simply wasn't in possession of the full facts. Some men, like E. Howard Hunt, although demoted, still remained inside the CIA and were still loyal to Alan Dulles. They held a grudge against the Kennedy brothers, that's for sure. John McConey wasn't old CIA. He was installed by Kennedy. Any plot within the agency would have likely been without his knowledge. Robert Kennedy suspected the CIA were guilty. Just a week after the murder of John Kennedy, President Lyndon Johnson summons his Chief Justice Earl Warren to the White House for an urgent meeting. This meeting is documented in official White House records and in the LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas. Johnson voices his intention to set up a commission to investigate the assassination of his predecessor. He wants Earl Warren to lead the investigation, but the Chief Justice is reluctant. President Johnson outlines the issues facing them in his unique, yet Texan style. He states that there are rumors that the Soviet Union and Cuba played a part in the assassination. He also says that rumors are circulating that Lee Harvey Oswald received $6,500 from the Castro government to carry out the hit on Kennedy. Johnson goes on and says that if people believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting as an agent of either Russia or Cuba, it will inevitably drag America into a war that could easily escalate into a nuclear Armageddon. Johnson piles the pressure on the Chief Justice by telling Warren just how many people globally would die in a nuclear exchange. Johnson can be quite persuasive when he isn't being forceful. Earl Warren succumbs to the president's emotional blackmail and accepts the job. The Warren Commission is established, and the Warren Commission's brief is made clear by Johnson from the get-go. The brief is to find that there was no conspiracy, communist or otherwise, and to prove that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting on his own when he killed President Kennedy. And that's precisely what the commission finds when it delivers its report in September 1964. The report's 888 pages are a complete whitewash, with key evidence and factual data ignored so that the required outcome could be achieved. Robert Kennedy publicly backs the commission's findings. In private, however, he rubbishes the investigation, remains highly skeptical, and still believes the CIA are guilty. John McConey, the CIA director who gave Bobby his word that the CIA had nothing to do with the assassination, is also unconvinced by the lone gunman verdict proposed by the Warren Commission. McConey publicly stated at the time of the Warren Commission's publication, quote, "There had to be a second shooter involved." Even some of the lawyers who served as investigators to the commission will later publicly question its findings. A number of commission members voice instances and concerns where the CIA and FBI deliberately blocked certain avenues of investigation, prevented access to evidence, and generally made the investigation as difficult as possible. Hell, even Richard Nixon, a former vice president who proceeded to take the presidency following Lyndon Johnson in 1969, will openly call the commission's findings grossly incorrect and the biggest hoax ever perpetuated against the American people. Yet history clung to the account that the Warren Commission delivered. Roger Stone, a conservative political consultant and lobbyist, who since the 1970s has worked as a political advisor to Republican presidential candidates such as Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bob Dole, and George H.W. Bush, published a book on January 1, 2013. It was titled, "The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ." Stone uses previously unknown historical evidence and first-hand testimony in his book to reveal the links to LBJ's guilt in the Kennedy plot. Quote, "Lyndon Johnson was vicious, crude, vindictive, corrupt, abusive, unbalanced, and evil," Stone stated in a November 2013 article with the Observer newspaper. Stone added, "President Nixon once told me personally that both he and Mr. Johnson badly wanted the presidency, but that unlike Mr. Johnson, Nixon wasn't willing to kill for it." Stone stated that Nixon knew Johnson had Kennedy killed and told him so on several occasions. The Warren Commission report was for the people. Those on Capitol Hill know differently. Stone is clear to point out that he is no conspiracy nut. He believes conspiracies such as the Roswell incident, US involvement in the 9/11 attacks, and other such stories are all complete bullshit. LBJ arranging the Kennedy hit is not a conspiracy, it's a historical fact, he says. He does, however, think that the CIA has done a great job in muddying the waters about the assassination by releasing fake stories and creating a lot of the conspiracy so that people have no idea what to believe anymore. Standard propaganda black ops. Philip F. Nelson, researcher and independent journalist, published on December 22, 2011, a book titled "The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination." The book is incredibly well-researched and detailed the torrid relationship between Kennedy and Johnson. Taken from White House records, Nelson explains, clearly and robustly, why it's clear that LBJ was behind Kennedy's assassination. Links to where you can get these books are on our website, www.deadsoulspodcast.com/history. Okay, let's consolidate and put things into clear framing. It goes something like this. On November 28, 1961, President John Kennedy fires Alan Dulles as head of the CIA. At the time, the White House claimed that Dulles had resigned. He didn't. He was forced out by the Kennedys after the Bay of Pigs disaster and John Kennedy's fears that the CIA had too much power. JFK wants to break the CIA up. Kennedy appoints close ally John McConey to replace Dulles. Vice President Johnson was a close friend and ally of Dulles. He was furious at Kennedy's decision to remove Dulles as CIA director and personally thought the Bay of Pigs fiasco was Kennedy's fault by not cozying up to the generals and intelligence community and agreeing to their plan and tactics on Cuba. On October 11, 1963, President Kennedy signs National Security Action Memorandum No. 263 to withdraw 1,000 American military personnel from Vietnam by the end of the year. Kennedy was beginning to pull out of Vietnam before it escalated. This was much to the disdain of the military-industrial complex and his military advisors. One of President Johnson's first acts on taking office was to hurriedly reverse that order. In doing so, he begins America's march to war in Vietnam, which his predecessor had been desperate to avoid. The argument is that Johnson represents the interests of the military-industrial complex, but also his own and close friends' financial interests. Something President Eisenhower warned the nation and his successor John Kennedy about in 1961. Military and intelligence agency hawks, who surround the president and stand to profit from America's presence in battle, particularly at this time in Vietnam, no matter how many American or Vietnamese will die, have nothing but contempt for John Kennedy. He is the first president who has stood up to them and refused their demands. According to this thesis, Kennedy stood in the way of their militarist objectives, and so he had to go. The corrupt Johnson, with significant financial stakes in the military, will be more cooperative and palatable, as his immediate reversal of Kennedy's order shows. Add to this the rumor that Kennedy intends to drop Johnson from the ticket for the 1964 election, and Bobby Kennedy's investigation into Johnson's shady business dealings at the Justice Department, and you have Lyndon Johnson, a proud and once incredibly powerful man, backed into a corner. On November the 18th, 1963, Kennedy visits Tampa and Miami in Florida. He is set to give a speech at the Inter-American Press Association. Prior to this, he is scheduled to take a motorcade trip through Miami in an opportunity to meet the people. The motorcade is cancelled at the very last minute by the Secret Service, however, after the Miami Police Department delivered an audio recording to the FBI and Secret Service, in which a man, identified by the informant who made the recording as Joseph Adams Miltia, who states that there is currently a plan in place to shoot President Kennedy from an office building with a high-powered rifle. Preceding this, three men, David Morales, Frank Sturgis, and E. Howard Hunt, meet up in a Miami hotel room in the summer of 1963. According to Hunt's account, it was Frank Sturgis who initially posed the question to him, the idea, the plot to kill the president. The plan had a codename The Big Event. The three men were loyal and close to Alan Dulles. Whilst evidence is only testimony and hearsay, it's likely that LBJ had raised the idea with Dulles, possibly via his fixer, Mack Wallace. The details were left up to the assassination team. After all, they had achieved the same mission quite easily in other nations. They were more than experienced and had all the contacts, military, government, mob, and foreign criminals. "You seem to have everything you need," Hunt claims that he initially responded with. "So why do you need me?" "I would argue that we can take this reaction with a pinch of salt," Hunt assured in his hubris and how he wanted the account to play out, without a doubt. The further and lower down you go into the plot, the murkier and less clear things seem to be. For example, we know there was a three-man French B-team positioned behind the fence above the grassy knoll. What's not so clear is who issued the contract and hired them. Both CIA and US mob are likely candidates, and we already know the CIA are involved, so likely them. However, as we will come to, there's also the possibility of a small mob inclusion further down the road, but I'll come to that. On the CIA's part, we know E. Howard Hunt, Cord Meyer, Bill Harvey, David Morales, David Attlee Phillips, and Frank Sturgis are all involved. Hunt and Sturgis were photographed dressed as tramps in Dealey Plaza on the day of the assassination, along with another man. The tramp photographs were uncovered by photographic expert, security consultant, and researcher Richard E. Sprague in 1970. By using computer detail analysis, he confirmed that two of the three tramps in the photographs were, in fact, Hunt and Sturgis. These claims are backed up by Hunt's sons, St. John and David. The three tramps were arrested hiding in a boxcar on the railroad behind Dealey Plaza. Police interviewed all three of the men, but destroyed their interview records, which was confirmed by the Dallas Police Department in 1975. Hunt was aware of the French team. He confirmed in his late-life confession he knew of Lucien Sarti. From this, let's assume that the second gunman on the grassy knoll were the CIA/French team. We also know from fingerprints confirmed by Dallas Police that LBJ's fixer, Mack Wallace, was in the Texas School Book Depository alongside Lee Harvey Oswald. This was likely a second team to create a triangulation of fire. A setup to create a perfect assassination turkey shoot, as explained by L. Fletcher Prouty, the ex-chief of special operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President John F. Kennedy and colonel in the US Air Force between 1941 to 1964. Prouty would go on to support Richard Sprague in his research in the 1970s and also advise the New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's investigation between 1966 and 1969. Prouty became an outspoken critic of the CIA and their illegal tactics after he retired from the military, citing his years of witnessing underhanded deeds and dirty plots by the agency. The only problem with his perfect assassination triangulation of fire was that it wouldn't work, Prouty said. Richard Sprague stated in a 1970 interview with Computers and Automation magazine that the computer photos analysis he had carried out showed evidence of 6 shots fired at John Kennedy. According to Sprague, President Kennedy was hit by 4 shots. Governor John Connally was hit by another, and one missed altogether. In September 1975, Sprague and Prouty gave an interview in the Milwaukee Sentinel and also a speech in the New York City for National Press, where they stated that their study of still photographs and film of the assassination revealed that no shots were fired from the Texas School Book Depository's 6th-floor window. Sprague and Prouty passed their research to Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, who was conducting research into the Kennedy assassination in order to bring charges against CIA-affiliated businessman Clay Shaw for his supposed involvement in the Kennedy plot. On December the 31st, 1968, an episode of The Tonight Show aired, and before a nationwide audience, Jim Garrison held up a photograph of the three tramps and suggested that they were CIA operatives involved in the assassination. That segment of the show was immediately shut down by the television network. Additionally, according to Sprague's research, because of the location of the large oak tree with dense foliage that crossed the trajectory of the shot from the 6th floor of the school book depository onto Elm Street, it is highly unlikely that Lee Harvey Oswald could fire from the window where the rifle was found and accurately strike his target. Worth noting is that a number of firearms experts over the years have tried to replicate this shot and have been unable due to various preventatives on each attempt. So let's say the other team, Oswald's team, were put in place to ensure that Oswald would be charged and apprehended for the plot, a patsy. He was likely not aware of his actual role. By the way, go back to episode 1 of this 3-part JFK series, and that should provide you with all the background information you need on Oswald. Now, one of Oswald's co-workers, Charles Givens, testified to the Warren Commission that he saw Oswald on the 6th floor of the school book depository at approximately 11:55 a.m. This was around 35 minutes before the motorcade. So we know he was there. Then, within a minute or two of the first shots being fired, a police motorcycle officer by the name of Marion Baker rushed into the book depository, where he was met by the depository's superintendent, Roy Truly. Upon request, Truly escorted Baker to the 6th floor to investigate the gunshots. On their way up the stairs, the two men came across Lee Harvey Oswald in the 2nd floor lunchroom. He was calmly drinking a Coke. Truly identified him to the officer, and the two men continued up the stairs. Given how Oswald was seen 4 floors below where the shots were supposedly fired from, just a minute or two after the first shot was fired and was calmly drinking a Coke, I would argue that he wasn't on the 6th floor at all when the shots were fired. Instead, I believe that he helped Mac Wallace set up on the 6th floor, then left him to what he thought would be to fire the shots and went down to the lunchroom while it happened. But after Oswald left the 6th, Wallace staged an assassination scene complete with Oswald's fingerprints from where Oswald helped set things up. Then Wallace sharply exited in an attempt to frame Oswald. We know that Oswald left the book depository shortly after being seen in the lunchroom and returned to his boarding house. Shortly after he leaves the boarding house, shoots a policeman by the name of J.D. Tippett, and heads to the Texas Theater to watch a movie. Sometime prior to the policeman being shot, he realizes he is being framed, and it's this that triggers him to kill Tippett and run. There are multiple eyewitnesses who have testimony to state that they saw Lee Harvey Oswald talking to Jack Ruby in his Carousel Club in the days prior to the assassination. Just one example of this is Madeline Brown, LBJ's mistress. If Oswald knew Ruby, which he likely did, this would indicate that Oswald's team was one set up as a dummy group, purely for Oswald to take the fall. Given Ruby's well-known links to the Chicago mob and Sam Giancana particularly, I think we can assume this contract was issued to the mob. After all, it didn't have to appear professional, and mistakes to a certain degree didn't matter. We know Oswald was likely low-level CIA, so the CIA planners likely offered Oswald as the patsy to the mob so he wouldn't be linked to them. Then, after framing him, Ruby paid off the Dallas Police Department, who he had well-known friendships and relationships with, to gain access to the police department parking garage, and then would shoot and kill Oswald with no known links. Ruby actually attempted to reveal to the Warren Commission all that he knew about the assassination plot, provided they could provide him with protection. The commission turned him down and chose not to hear what he had to say. The CIA kept a significant amount of information from the Warren Commission investigation, particularly what they knew about Oswald. Years later, we know a hell of a lot about Oswald, and it's clear that the information they withheld would have indicated his involvement with the agency. That would have brought the blame directly to the CIA's front door if it emerged at the time, so the CIA would leak false information throughout the years about him and his shady past. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy was a black mark on the history of the United States, and many argue it was the dawn of shady politics, lies, power plays, and a government who were now self-serving and no longer for the people. Lee Harvey Oswald was, in his own words, a patsy, a fall guy, nothing more than a pawn in a plot hatched by Lyndon Baines Johnson, the 36th President of the United States, with the support of the CIA and the Mafia. The fatal shot that killed Kennedy was fired by a French hitman named Lucien Sarti, who committed the crime for just $1,000 worth of heroin. These are my beliefs from the facts, testimony, and evidence which I have been able to unearth. All my sources can be found on our website, once again, at www.deadsoulspodcast.com/history. As always, I encourage you to form your own conclusions. Good night.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.